A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A glance around the globe shows that because of the state terrorism of the US, the world has been plunged into wars, bloodshed, genocide, occupation, economic recession, poverty, piracy, repression of masses by unrepresentative regimes, and even destruction of the natural environment. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan, International Staff Writer. This article is published under the heading Time to Decisively Confront U.S. Crimes Against Humanity. Stay tuned for more. The world would indeed be a peaceful place if the criminal cliques that rule the United States of America, whether Democrat or Republican, were to abide by international law and cease terrorization of nations. This is nothing but wishful thinking. Washington, where thugs and rogues rule the roost, will never end its crimes against humanity unless the free world unites to decisively confront it. A glance around the globe shows that because of the state terrorism of the U.S., the world has been plunged into wars, bloodshed, genocide, occupation, economic recession, poverty, piracy, repression of masses by unrepresentative regimes, and even destruction of the natural environment. It is the United States of America which pushed Ukraine into an undesirable conflict in a bid to weaken, isolate, and blame Russia. It is the United States of America which holds not just most of the so-called Third World, but also industrialized Europe as hostage to its hegemony. It is the U.S. which has built a doomsday arsenal of weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear, chemical, biological, etc., and has the unpardonable criminal record of dropping atomic bombs on Japan when the Second World War was virtually over, with Japanese imperialist troops on full retreat from all fronts. It is the U.S. which supports the illegal existence of Israel on Palestinian soil and its unabated genocide of the Palestinian people, in addition to using the Zionist entity as a base to terrorize the Muslim countries of West Asia and North Africa. It is the U.S. which, besides its unfair trade war against China, blatantly meddles in the breakaway island of Taiwan to try to undermine Beijing's rapidly increasing stature as a world power. It is the U.S. which has imposed a destructive war on Yemen through its clients, Saudi Arabia and the UAE. It is the U.S. which destroyed Afghanistan, destabilized Syria through the Takfiri terrorists, and continues to poke its dirty nose into the affairs of Iraq, as well as of Lebanon, in a bid to prevent national solidarity and formation of any broad-based government, even after elections. It is the U.S. which plunders the rich natural resources of Africa by exploiting dark-skinned people whose cousins, the Afro-Americans, are heavily discriminated against at home and subject to killing or imprisonment on the slightest pretext. It is the United States which is holding Latin America in thrall through its support of dictators and sanctions, or more properly, economic terrorism against independent countries like Cuba and Venezuela. It is the U.S., which is the biggest contributor to emission of dangerous gases into the atmosphere that have led to climate crises, deforestation, gradual extinction of many animal and bird species, pollution of the sea, and is tearing apart of the ozone protective layer of planet Earth. Last but not the least, the U.S. is the sworn enemy of Iran and the Iranian people because of their courage to confront the Yankees, in spite of the illegal sanctions of the past four decades and frequent acts of terrorism, including assassination of senior officials and acts of piracy on the high seas, the latest being the seizure of an oil tanker off the coast of Greece. All these crimes against humanity and numerous other acts of terrorism worldwide means it is time the free world got together to decisively confront the U.S. We are fully confident that the day will soon come when the United States of America disintegrates into several republics and cease to be great Satan that it is.
The Spotlight. Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The annual flag march by extremist Israeli settlers through Al-Quds Old City planned to go ahead. This is regarded by Palestinians as a blatant provocation and also a violation of their rights, even though Palestinian resistance groups have warned Israel against this, saying that they will retaliate if the regime goes ahead with a provocative march. The Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said that Israel is determined to hold the flag march. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at why Israel is disregarding what is seen as being provocative, while at the same time provoking Palestinians into a possible confrontation. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of the Spotlight. Editor at Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett, joins us from Madison. Also joining us from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mick Napier, who joins us from Edinburgh.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Kevin Barrett, first over to you. We're looking at a march that is deemed to be controversial and provocative. Maybe you can give us a background as to why that is being deemed as such.
The 1967 War of Aggression, which is recognized as such essentially by the whole international community, was organized in order to steal land that the Zionists felt they needed or wanted. And in the case of Jerusalem al-Quds, it was more wanting than needing it. They didn't need it for military purposes so much as a symbolic kind of triumph for them to proclaim that they, the Zionist movement, now totally owned and dominated the Holy Land that had been administered by Muslims on behalf of Jews and Christians, as well as Muslims, ever since Islam began. So there was a symbolic dimension to this, and the Israelis fanatically celebrated the Zionist takeover of the Holy City, and the ethnic cleansing process began as very large numbers of Palestinians were immediately expelled, and that process has continued to this day. So by running around waving flags, celebrating a criminal war of aggression — remember, aggression is the supreme war crime, and this war had been plotted for years by Ben-Gurion and others going back to the 1950s. This war crime is being not just celebrated, but being kind of shoved in the face of the victims, that is, the remaining Palestinians who haven't yet been ethnically cleansed. And by running around waving these flags, they're symbolic of genocide and ethnic cleansing in their faces, is essentially bragging about continuing this ethnic cleansing process. And we're seeing that happen all the time as they're still demolishing buildings. They're using fake legal processes to evict Palestinians. And there is an ongoing Zionist Jewish demographic takeover of Jerusalem al-Quds. So naturally, this is a little bit like when Nazis marched through Skokie, Illinois, here in the United States many, many years ago, waving swastika flags in a Jewish neighborhood in order to provoke the residents.
Okay.
And similarly, the same thing is happening here.
Now, what we understand, McNabb, here, is that this, according to the way that Israeli sees it, is meant to celebrate the capture of al-Quds back in the 1967 war. But when they went ahead and annexed that area, that is a step that is not recognized by the international community. So it's a law that's being broken by the way that they have gone about this. So why is it that they are able to mark this when it's illegal by international standards?
Because those international standards are formally acknowledged on paper by, for example, my government, but even the USA some of the time and the EU. But the way they respond to that is by supporting and arming those who violate those very same norms. Our other guest has said that aggressive war is the ultimate crime in the international canon. But, you know, that, and it, because it's the source of all the other crimes that flow from it, but my own government is quite ready to endorse aggressive wars. But if you can focus on Jerusalem in particular, the reason why Palestinian resistance factions and the whole Palestinian people, I would say, are very concerned about this march is because they remember what happened a year ago. And if you remember, horrible pictures were sent around the world of police attacking, Palestinians defending the Al-Aqsa Mosque, rubber bullets, tear gas. In fact, so much tear gas and other inflammable material was fired that a tree in the compound went on fire. And that picture of seemingly the Al-Aqsa Mosque on fire caused noisy celebrations in the Jewish plaza below the Wailing Wall. It was a genocidal demonstration. People were celebrating a fire at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. They were very much hoping that the mosque would be burned down. They were chanting genocidal slogans about the Palestinians, quote unquote, may their names be erased, biblical slogans for the mod. And these people were celebrating what they thought was a fire at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And remember, these demonstrations are endorsed by the Israeli government. Sometimes they take some cold feet, but generally they're endorsed. And many of the most genocidal groups taking part in these demonstrations actually receive funding from the Israeli government. And you have to think about these youths. They're generally young men who are demonstrating, calling for genocide against the Palestinians. In a year or two's time, they will be in uniform in the occupied territories or maintaining the siege of Gaza, and they will operate with complete impunity or an ability to shoot and kill Palestinians. Connect what we saw a year ago in the March of the Flag, so-called Jerusalem Day March, with the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh, who was killed with complete impunity by an Israeli sniper. The general mood among these youths and many of these soldiers is murderous. And the fact that it's celebrated openly by the Jerusalem Day March is, of course, shocking to some liberal people who would like to defend Israel. But it really marks the political tendency inside Israel that's in the ascendant at the moment. And one member of the Israeli parliament, more than one, several of them call for the destruction of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And they operate completely openly as heroes to a big section of the Israeli public. So the resistance factions are obviously very concerned. They realize they have to take a stand. Israel will only respect force in this area.
I guess there, Kevin Barrett talks about how the lead up to this national, as Israelis call it, the so-called National Flag Day, which is going to be attended by Israeli nationalists or Israeli extremist settlers, along with the fact that you have the assassination of that reporter, Shireen Abu Akleh, and all the tensions that exist with other deaths that have occurred in the past days, is not the right time for this to have happened. Why is it that given that you have the prime minister, which at some point this was actually delayed, okay this march, that would possibly just flare up that area, if not the region?
Well, of course, we have to suspect that even though it's not the right time from the perspective of those of us who would prefer peace, it may be the right time from the perspective of Bennett and the other extremist crazies who run Israel. They typically do stage these provocations at the times when they have scheduled something that will work with them. And so we've seen in the past that at the convenient times that the Israelis want an excuse to crack down, for instance, to mow the lawn, as they call it, in Gaza and slaughter a few thousand civilians for no particular reason other than just mowing the lawn, they provoke Palestinians. We saw this, for instance, in early 2001, as Israel was preparing for its September 11th false flag operation in the United States, carried out with neoconservatives who were theoretically dual loyalists, but I think actually more loyal to Israel than the United States. they were going to use 9/11 as an excuse to crush the Palestinian movement. And, of course, they would, with extreme violence, not just murdering all sorts of people in Palestine, but also murdering Edward Said here in the United States, murdering, of course, Yasser Arafat, and so on. So they used 9/11 to crush the Palestinian movement. And the way they were able to set that up, at least the part in occupied Palestine, was by leading, you know, Ariel Sharon leading these kinds of invasions of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, getting the Palestinians all stirred up, getting a lot of footage of what the Western media, which is dominated by Jewish folks with some degree of loyalty to Zionism, would call clashes. So they get the clashes going, then they stage whatever it is that they're looking for, and they use the excuse of so-called clashes or Palestinian resistance to get what they want. So I think they're probably planning something. I don't know precisely what it is, but I don't think this is accidental. I think the Israeli authorities or whoever is behind them are planning to perhaps expand the war one way or another, whether going after Hezbollah, maybe even going after Iran in a bigger way than they have, maybe bombing Syria in a bigger way than they have, maybe cracking down on the Palestinians in an even bloodier way than they have so far. And they're going to use the excuse that there have been clashes and unrest. And of course, they're the ones who produce the so-called clashes and unrest. It's all a response to their own aggression.
All right. While Kevin Barrett was speaking there, McNapp here, I went to look at what you were talking about when you talked about the celebrations that some of these Israelis or extremists, if you want to call them, or the settlers were celebrating based on the fire that happened at that Al-Aqsa Mosque. And what I'm looking at over here is just a particular, I guess, a tweet at that point. It doesn't matter who tweeted it, but it said, crazy image of thousands of Israelis celebrating this what they call Jerusalem Day, while a fire blazes on the Temple Mount where Arabs are protesting and police is trying to stop them. When you take a look at this type of sentiment, are we looking just at what is being termed as Israeli nationalists or extremist settlers who hold this view? Or are we looking at the broad spectrum when it comes to Israelis as a whole, holding that type of views on Palestinians?
I use the word in commas. American Jewish newspaper The Forward reported, together with many others, a couple of elections ago, that the election between Netanyahu and Gantz, and it's really repeated in almost every election, who could boast that they had killed the most Palestinians. Netanyahu, of course, was a deeply racist anti-Palestinian prime minister. But he was challenged from the so-called center ground by Benny Gantz. And in the election, Gantz had an election video in which he showed pictures of Palestinian funerals in Gaza. And in the corner of the video was a counter of how many people had been killed. Terrorists, he said, but he means Palestinians, during this attack on Gaza. And he boasted in this election video, please vote for me, I pushed Gaza back to the Stone Age. Now, it doesn't get any more revolting than that to ask for votes from the general public because you are more murderous than your opponent, that you show pictures of funerals and you have a death counter in the corner of your election video. There is so much evidence to show that the Israeli so-called left has disappeared. And the spectrum of political opinion in Israel is pretty much right, extreme right, and genocidal right. And they compete for the popular vote. And there's nothing Jewish about this. This is fairly standard in a settler colonial project, where the whole aim in South Africa or centuries earlier America or Australia or Israel or Palestine today, the aim is to remove all the native people by violence, because you can't do it by singing songs. And because it's an inherently violent project of ethnic cleansing, it has to constantly energize its own base. It has to discuss genocide. It has to allow murderous elements to actually come to the fore. Because if you tried to stop that, the whole logic of Zionism would be challenged. Look, the ex-chief rabbi in Britain, a guy called Jonathan Sachs, who presented himself as a liberal, He made a personal appeal for Jews to come with him to the March of the Flags in Jerusalem. He said, and dance with our brave Israeli soldiers. That was in Britain. And the British political establishment went along with that. Similar stories could be shown from all around the world. Mm. The Palestinians are in great danger. They have the local Arab regimes in the Gulf and Morocco and Egypt are working together with Israel. They even share intelligence and weapons and so on. And the Palestinians are deeply alarmed. Who are their allies? Who can they rely upon? And they're beginning to realize that their doom is the only alternative to resist. Not beginning, sorry. They've always understood this. But if they don't resist this, then there is no limit to Zionist appetites to remove them.
There have been signs of improvement in the way that Palestinians are making their cause to show, especially to the world, Kevin Barrett. And this Ramadan, there was one instance where you had some Palestinian youths, as it was reported, to have managed to actually bring into the site of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, where the Dome of the Rock was, a picture or a banner, actually, not a picture, a banner of a Hamas fighter, of which they hung up in front of the Dome of the Rock. And that's something that a few years ago, based on one particular senior Western diplomat, as he was quoted, was saying that it just wouldn't be unimaginable for something like that to happen in Al-Quds. So what does that say about the way that Palestinians have resisted and in defiance and taking all the risks that involves probably their lives to have managed to done something like this?
That's right. You know, our hearts have to go out to these brave young Palestinians who are carrying the torch of resistance to genocide after these generations have passed before them. And the Zionists have arranged things so that for each individual Palestinian, the easiest way to go is to try to find a way to get out and go try to thrive somewhere else and forget about the whole issue. That's part of the ethnic cleansing process. As you kill some, you expel others, and then you make it easier for the survivors to leave than to stay. But there have been brave Palestinians who've been staying and struggling throughout the entire process. And indeed, the genocide of Palestine has been a failure. They have not managed to drive out the Palestinians, and indeed they're still facing what they call a demographic problem, which is one of the reasons that they celebrate, you know, exterminating these the people they call cockroaches and so on, putting up little counters to count how many civilians that they murder, because they see that they have not succeeded in their extermination project. So these young Palestinians who are still fighting are incredibly courageous, and they really stand in sharp contrast to the wealthy, pampered elites in parts of the Arab world, especially the Gulf, where it seems that at least among the elites, they've decided that it's better to work with the Zionist Antichrist than to resist it. And so these Palestinian young people are setting an example for all of us in all parts of the world struggling for justice on so many issues. The young people here in North America who are struggling against the COVID tyranny that's being imposed based on this U.S. bioweapons disaster of COVID-19, and then maybe this new U.S. bioweapons monkeypox disaster. There is a huge resistance movement here in the United States and Canada and across Europe. And there are so many other of these issues where this over-the-top oppression, what we call dhulm in Islam, is being resisted, and especially by these brave young people who have everything to lose and have their whole lives to live. So we just have to salute them.
McNabb here, maybe we can take just a quick time from you to explain how Palestinians revere, obviously, the Al-Aqsa Mosque. I mean, during the month of Ramadan and prior, even to the prior Ramadans, Palestinians, especially the younger ones, they actually pay smugglers to bring them into the compound so that they can just go and pray, because Israeli forces, obviously, if they see them, they won't allow them in because they have restrictions when it comes to age, and usually it's the younger ones that are restricted. And that's how holy and how high in value this particular praying is for them. But that is considered, as Israel sees it, terrorism if they were to come in. But yet when they have the Israeli settlers or Israeli nationals walking through, that's okay. Can you open that up for us a little bit, if you can?
Yes. I mean, if Jews are attacked in Britain, as sometimes happens, genuine anti-Semitism, we obviously support them. But in Israel, in Palestine, we have a Jewish supremacist state. And although it was founded largely by atheists, the vanguard of the ethnic cleansing operation has to some degree been taken over by religious extremists. And for them, the Al-Aqsa Mosque is something that they simply have to destroy. So for Palestinians, it's clearly a religious institution of the highest importance, and it should be across the whole Muslim world. But it's also the heart of their Palestinian identity. And, you know, there's never been a day in Palestine, people should celebrate this, when Muslims and Christians have fought. They have always coexisted peacefully together, and they did with Jews before the dark shadow of Zionism appeared. And, you know, when the Israeli regime has moved against Muslims, Christian groups have said, you can come and make the call to prayer from our churches, from our church steeples. So it's a very important institution, not only for Muslims, but for the whole Palestinian people. And for that very reason, it's a target for the Israelis. The Israelis want to remove Palestinians. They also want to obliterate Palestinian history. And that, and part of that is obliterating the religion of the great majority of Palestinians for its replacement by a Jewish supremacist state. That's why it's so fantastically important for Palestinians to defend their own history, their own memory, their present culture, and their hopes for the future. And it's equally important for the Israelis at some stage to find the right moment to destroy it. And unless Muslims worldwide come to the support of the Palestinians, they may succeed.
All right, last question goes to you, Kevin Barrett. Benny Gantz, who said that this march has to go on, came out and in defiance of just everybody saying that, you know, you're going to look at clashes that are going to happen on that day. He said, "You will not threaten our sovereignty," quote, is what Benny Gantz said, believing that also that there's not going to be any type of retaliation or a repeat, I should say, of what happened last year where Hamas had rockets fired into Israel, and it was quite successful in doing so. Why do you think Benny Gantz would say that? When Hamas has clearly threatened Israel with retaliation?
He's obviously trying to provoke the Palestinians to create the very clashes that he thinks he can profit from one way or another. Perhaps they're planning an operation, as I suggested, or perhaps he's just trying to benefit politically. As we heard, who counts the most Palestinian civilian body, the one who wins the insane genocidal. So he doesn't mind these clashes. Doesn't mind killing. He well is trying to trigger it, that he's doing. And the Palestinians are defending this, as he said, because Al-Aqsa is a crucial spiritual symbol for Muslims and indeed to some extent for Eastern Christians as well, who've been living side by side with Muslims in peace for so many centuries. The Al-Aqsa Mosque is the place where the Prophet Muhammad rose through the heavens, and it's the symbol of Islamic spirituality in this tradition of Abrahamic monotheism. It's a beautiful, important place, and the people defending it deserve our thanks and our praise.
Thank you. We're fresh out of time. Thank you for that, Kevin Barrett, editor at Veterans Today from Madison, and Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Meek Napier there from Edinburgh. Thank you for your comments. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Tapway and the team. It's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend and esteemed guest speaker, Sheikh Nur Muhammad from the Islamic Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, I welcome you and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh. The pleasure is all ours. Our question today has been sent by one of our listeners, and it is about dreams. So some people, maybe a lot of people, when they sleep and they dream, sometimes they are visited by their deceased family relatives. Are these types of dreams true dreams, what we call ru'ya sadiqa, an actual dream? Or is it just figments of the imagination or memories? And in extension of this, what is then a proper dream, a true dream?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As you mentioned, that most of the dreams that ordinary people have it, they are from among the adqatu ahlam, according right. to the verse of Noble Quran, means that some false dream that people have it. And it is because of the power of imagination of human being, and because they sometimes people they engage in this material life, they are engaged in many other points that the mind is full and busy with different things, you know,
yes.
detailed
right.
thing they thinking about, and because of this engagement, and because the mind is busy, when they have sleep. Okay, they have a kind of dream, and this dream is considered to be false dream, and we cannot rely that. They are not reliable dreams, and according to the verses of Noble Quran, you know, we have other type of dream, which is ru'ya sadaqa, okay, right. true dreams. This ru'ya sadaqa has a lot of condition for that, if you want to have that kind of dream. First of all, talk about the time of that. Time of that, it has been mentioned, is in the time of Sahar, before dawn. Okay.
Right.
Another condition of that is that individual should be in the pure condition.
Right.
Okay. Ma'at tahara, which means in the pure condition with ablution.
Ritual of ablution, course, of course.
Ritual ablution before
right.
the going to sleep. Not to be in the, for example, ritual ablution, not to be junub, which we say that it is kind of impurity for
right.
the individual. This janaba actually is causing from the sexual intercourse. And be in the position of remembrance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. According to this narration, Imam said that, ذكر الله حقيقة ذكره, which means to have this kind of a spiritual and heart relation with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Okay?
Right.
By this condition, if we observe these conditions that Imam alayhi salatu wasalam mentioned, then you can have ru'ya sadaqa. But it is not very easy done. Because if you want to have real mentioning and remembrance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, it requires, you know, cleansing of hearts. Okay,
right.
your heart must be clean from any kind of, you know, deviation.
Impurities, sins.
Impurities, right. sins. And, you know, in that case, maybe you have the opportunity of having ru'ya sadaqa. But I have to mention that it is rarely that people, they can have these ru'ya sadaqa. And for the most case, they understand that whether it was the ru'ya sadaqa or adghathu ahlam, because spiritually speaking, when you are in the very nice situation, you are away from any kind of sin, and you have this kind of muraqabah, which means always maintain your relationship with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you
right.
maybe you have the opportunity and privilege of having these ru'ya sadaqa.
So upon these ru'ya sadaqa, you call it a privilege. So who sees these dreams? Is there a message behind them? or is it just some privilege, a gift to them? What is the, should we call the tafsir, the tafsir, the exegesis, the meaning of these dreams?
You know, my brother, talking about the interpretation of such dreams, you know, it has its own story, because right, only few people, they can interpret the dreams. I know that, you know, many, unfortunately, many claimants, many people, they claim that we can interpret the dream, and there are a lot of books has been published over there about this issue, about ta'wil al-ru'ya, interpretation of the dreams. But most of them, and most of these people, if it's not all of them, they are not reliable one. Okay?
Right.
I want to say that the if you observe this condition that Imam mentioned, and the most important of that, it was remembering and muraqabah of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Always have your spiritual relationship with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Then you have the, I can say, the gift from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Right.
That you witness and you have very clear dream that... For example,
you understand the dream.
You understand it.
Yes, you do not need a tafsir or explanation.
Because of that, I use the very clear and obvious dream.
Yes, right.
Because it is actually the gift from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. For very few people, they can have the privilege of having these kind of dreams. And that dream, maybe the questioner asked about the visiting the dead people. Yes, it is possible. It is possible that you go to the realm of that, which we call it Alamul Mithal. It's kind of realm that after this life, you go to the another life, which we call it Alamul Barzakh, a kind of mediator between this life and the Day of Judgment. Of course, I do not want to go to the explanation of that, because it requires a lot of explanation, which kind of character it has, what is the explanation of that.
Right.
But I want to say that very briefly, it is possible to do that, but possible for very few people who observe these conditions, who have a lot of qualification to have these ru'ya sadiqa and the true dream.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
So a question then that might arise: is it possible for somebody to not have these qualifications to be blessed by Allah to have such a dream?
No. Usually it is not. Because Imam alayhi salatu wasalam, in that particular narration that I share with you, he mentioned that it must be, these conditions should be met. Okay?
And they without, must be met.
Yeah. This condition must be met. And without this condition, it is not possible for the evil people, for example, suddenly...
Not evil people, but some people who are not that religious, they also claim, and happens, they saw, for example, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, they had a problem in their life, and then they saw the Imam in their dreams, and they spoke to him, and then their hajat, their needs, they were fulfilled.
You know, my brother, we cannot rely on that, okay? Because the point is that not only dream, we have another idea, especially in the mysticism, Islamic mysticism, which we call it shuhud, which means that kind of witnessing some realities.
Right. And that's only a hujjah for those who witnessed it.
Exactly.
Right.
These could be proof, I repeat that, it could be proof for the those people who witness it.
Right.
Okay?
And only.
if that's witnessing, which we call it, shuhud, has its proper condition.
Of course.
If it has its accurate way and introduction for that. Because many people, unfortunately, especially false claimants, they claim that, yes, I have the dream of Imam al-Mahdi, I visited the noble Prophet Muhammad, Prophet Muhammad, and he told me that, for example, that person is your guide, and so on and so forth. Unfortunately, lots of misguided people want to misuse this idea, okay, right, and to claim many other false idea via this false dream. The point is that, my brother, if that condition, I want to say that any dream, any shuhud, any witnessing, if it has been done by its accurate way, okay, by accurate introduction, it is acceptable for that individual. If it is not done, I mean, the condition have not been met, so nobody, even that individual, him or herself, cannot rely on that.
Okay, right.
It is for sure. You know, it is granted. Because I know that many people, unfortunately, they claim many ideas. Even they do not have the minimal, let's say, condition for that. But they bring about many other claims that they are baseless.
Would you then, dear Sheikh, in your expertise and according to the narrations and the verses of the Holy Quran, could it be said then that if you've reached a certain maqam status, a certain level of taqwa, of piety, that you will see such a dream? Or is it also at that stage only to some?
As I said, if you have the condition, if you have all these conditions, of course, it is possible for you to have that
dream. It's possible. It is not a given that you must see such a dream.
No, it is not given. Because it is only from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Right.
Okay? And it is not for sure that you will have that dream. Okay? The point here is that, and I want to emphasize on that, is that you have to observe all the conditions. If you do that, maybe Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will give you this privilege of having this ru'ya sadaqa, which is a true dream.
So, dear Sheikh, with all of these requirements met, we do have some scholars, not from our sect, for our Sunni Muslim brothers, but also from other Muslims who are not Shia Muslims. They also see these dreams. And they meet the criteria according to themselves. They are pious, religious. They sleep with ritual ablution, and they saw this dream at such and such and so time. So the question is, if we then start accepting these dreams as being valid, it can open a whole other door of, perhaps we call it inhiraf, of corruption, because some might say, I saw the Prophet tell me that Umar and Abu Bakr, they are the righteous caliphs. And another will see, I saw the Imam Mahdi, and he told me that I will be his successor, perhaps. And it escalates. So how can we go about this, dear Sheikh? What is our stance on these dreams, generally, to avoid such corruption?
You see that, as I said, we have a lot of false claimant in this issue. Many people claim that, and you said that, for example, they brought about the denomination, and they want to say that, how can I support that denomination by saying that, for example, my cult is true because I've witnessed I saw the noble prophet in my dream, that he supported me and he gave me a lot of instruction.
Right.
You see that, my brother, in narrations, we have a lot of criteria for those people who want to have, accurate, let's say, dream. But first of all, it is established that dream at all it is not considered to be one of the proofs.
Okay.
Right. One of the hujjah. Hujjah is noble Quran and wisdom and the narration and consensus, according to some scholars, right, these are considered to be your proof and your hujjah. Nobody says that dream or witness or anything else beside that they are hujjah.
Of course.
Of course. You want to say that, maybe they have some dreams and witnesses, which we call it shuhud, but they are, if it has been in true way and be all conditions have and introduction have been met, can be proof for that person, for that individual.
Right.
It is not proof at all. Nobody can say that.
Right.
Yes, for
you cannot
others
face Allah on Judgment Day and see and say that I believed in so-and-so because such person saw this dream.
Even for that individual, maybe for the most cases, cannot be proved. I want to add this point.
Of course.
For that individual, because most of them, if not all of them, they do not meet all conditions. For example, the condition of that is, as I said, the remembrance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, acceptance, the guardianship of Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. That it is a basic element, an introduction for that person in order to have Ruya Sadiqa.
Right.
I want to say that for a scholarly analysis, we cannot rely on any dream or any witness. Rather, we should go to a rational analysis or, for example, the verse of Noble Quran or the narrations of Ahlul Bayt.
And with that, we will have to end today's program because we are out of time. I thank you, dear Sheikh, for joining us today, and I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. Until next time, fi amanillah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Li Aliyin wa Husayn wa Hasan. Li Aliyin wa Husayn wa Hasan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The road to Svetlodarsk, a town in Donbass recently taken by the Russian army and separatist militias. The town is home to around 10,000 people, most of whom stayed during the fighting. I'm surprised to see little damage here.
Nothing happened, fortunately, in the town itself. But the joint forces of the DPR, LPR, and Russia broke the so-called Svetlodarsk Arc, and the enemy lost all interest in fighting and left, so the battle is now behind the town. Kiev do not give their army enough motivation. We're on our land, and we're defending it. And at the moment, we're going forward. They are on foreign land.
Up on this plinth, in this square here, there would have been a Russian statue. My translator think it may have been a statue of Lenin, but the Ukrainians have been pulling down these statues, trying to erase any Russian culture or signs of Russian culture in areas they take. But now this is back under Russian control, this town.
These last 8 years, we've been living under humiliation. And when the Russian soldiers came, we've been waiting for them. For we are also Russians. We understand Russians. We think and live like Russians do. That's why we were waiting for them.
First of all, I think it will be easier to breathe. We do not understand yet. Our fear is that the Russian military will move on and leave the town without defense, and that we will be under shelling again.
I'm taken to a townhouse which served as a Ukrainian military base. The remnants of what the soldiers left as they fled. They tried to hide tanks here, but the building was still struck by a Russian airstrike.
Now these are pictures drawn by children, quite possibly sent to the Ukrainian soldiers. These ones here say, "We want peace." This one here says, "Please return alive."
As the Russian army continues their advance in Donbass, more towns like this, in the coming days and weeks, will raise the Russian flag.
Meanwhile, civilians throughout the Donbass, whether pro-Russian or pro-Ukrainian, will be hoping that this war will soon come to an end.
What they lack in number, they make up for in solidarity. Supporters of a British pro-Palestine priest facing a week-long Church of England tribunal here for his views on Israel. 68-year-old Reverend Stephen Sizer, a retired Anglican vicar known for his opposition to Christian Zionism, a belief among some Christians that the establishment of Israel in 1948 was in accordance with biblical prophecy, accused of anti-Semitism.
We're concerned about how people who are speaking up against the crimes against humanity that are being committed by apartheid Israel are being targeted. And people and organizations in this country that are apologists for apartheid, that are actually supportive of the apartheid state of Israel, are actually using regulatory processes to actually target individuals and stop any kind of dissent from being said.
One such group, the Pro-Israel Board of Deputies of British Jews, that's accused Dr. Sizer of making public statements that conflicts with the so-called International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism adopted by the Church of England. The definition conflates harsh criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism.
There's no exemption from their attempt to shut down pro-Palestinian discourse. And the reason is very simple. They've lost the debate. If they were winning the debate, they wouldn't be trying to shut down Stephen Sizer. But they know that public opinion, because of what Israel does and because of the Palestinian resistance, they know that they're very, very unpopular in public opinion.
And it's not the first time this is happening. Dr. Sizer faced similar accusations in 2013, but was exonerated in return for not posting about Palestine on social media. Nearly 10 years later, he's once again the subject of a pro-Israel witch hunt.
I think it's because Reverend Dr. Stephen Sizer was not obedient, and he continued to advocate for Palestine and against the crimes of the State of Israel, and they decided to bring him to heel in an exemplary way. You know, they've pretty much cleaned out the Labour Party. They've got scalps there. They've attacked people in academia. They got people fired in Bristol. They've even tried to take on musicians like Lowkey.
A final verdict is expected in the coming weeks, but what this case and similar ones show, these activists say, is the length to which the British state will go in silencing all criticism of Israel and its apartheid against Palestinians. Saeed Bourizza, London.
On Friday, two-time Prime Minister of Italy and former President of the European Union, Romano Prodi, had his say on the Ukraine crisis and subsequent geopolitical developments during a meeting with journalists held at the International Press Association headquarters in Rome, known for having overseen an extensive privatization of Italy's public assets and for his lack of ostentation. Prodi is today a retired politician. He expressed serious concerns at how the sanctions imposed against Russia over the conflict in Ukraine will reverberate through the European Union, with the risk of creating divisions among the members of the bloc.
The Ukraine crisis fallout will hit the EU badly. Sanctions would cost a lot to Italy and Germany, less to other EU countries. Brussels has reacted unitedly to Russia, but peace must remain paramount.
Italy and Germany are the countries which have relied on Russian energy the most over the past 20 years. Rome has been trying to diversify its energy sources, but it will take at least 2-3 years before it achieves a total replacement of Russian gas. Since the start of the war in Ukraine, Rome has been trying to wean itself off Russian gas, which currently accounts for over 40% of total gas imports. However, according to the National Bureau of Statistics, is that Italy's imports from Russia rose